Okay, so we started, whatever that was, 4 weeks ago, the sort of the downturn in Sefer Bamidbar, the beginning of the rebellions, and we'd started talking about the leadership crisis that ensues starting at this point in Bamidbar. So that's really what I want to sort of explore, because that really is that's really what takes us through the book at this point. So the story we had been in the had, that we'd started touching on, we're going to do the other half of it, is the story of the complaints. So in Perek Yud Aleph in Bamidbar, so the Torah tells us that the people were complaining. They turned to God and they told him that we want meat. And God, we remember all the great food that we had when we were in Mitzrayim. We had the vegetables, we had these gourds and the onions and the garlic, and now all we have is the man, and we don't want the man. And Moshe really loses his temper at that. And he says, right, why have you done so? Why have you been so terrible? He turns to God and he says, why have you been so terrible to me? Why haven't I found favor in your eyes that I have to carry this burden? Did I give birth to this people? Did I conceive them? Did I give birth to them? That you're telling me to carry them, like a nurse would carry a baby. And where am I going to get meat from? So if we skip to so Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Yud Dalet, right? He said, "Lo uchal anochi levadi lasid kol am hazeh ki chaved mimeni." He said, "I can't carry them anymore. It's too heavy." Vim kachad aselia hargeni na rog. And this is what you want to do to me. You want me to lead these people? Just kill me. If I found favor in your eyes, just kill me. And we already noted how this is striking. That in Shmot, he's saying to Hashem, "If you want to kill the Jewish people, erase me from your book." And now he's saying, "If I found favor in your eyes, kill me." Right, he's begging God to get him out of the story. I can't handle this anymore. So we'd already touched on this, but I just wanted to add a point to it. So we'd asked why it was that Moshe loses his temper here, and that's really a two-pronged question. One is that we see him standing up for the Jewish people time and time again in seemingly worst sins. And the second thing is that it's not just that in worse sins he stands up for them. We've been through this before. In Bishalach, the Jews complained to God about water and food. Like this is not even like the first time this complaint has happened. So why does Moshe lose his patience now? So now one interpretation that sort of negates the question is the Bechor Shor. Yosef Bechor Shor, sort of the end of the Ashkenazi Pshat movement. Towards the end of it, he actually says that it's an illusion. There isn't two stories, right? In Bishalach, we'd had the first time when they complained for water and God gave them water, and he complained for food and they gave them food. He actually says that that story is the same as this story. There aren't two stories. They didn't complain twice. It's just that you got like a synopsis of what was going to happen in Bishalach, and it happens here. And the truth is that Moshe didn't really stick up for them that much then either. You just didn't hear the whole story. Now you're hearing the whole story, and he's complaining. He says the same thing, by the way, about the two hitting of the rocks, right? He says, right, that the first time, it's not the first time it was a good thing to hit the rock, and the second time it wasn't. He just said they're the same story, and you didn't hear about the negative aspects of it until till now. I gave that to you in one, right? He said, to hit the rock. It seems to me, this is the same story as we saw before. He said, the focus in Shmot was how does God support the Jewish people. It's the same story, just that Shmot doesn't talk about the negatives, because Shmot is describing how good God is to the Jewish people, and now Bamidbar talks about how bad the Jewish people are to God, so we hear the other aspect of it. But it's the same story. He said, how do you know? Because there, We called the place Masa Umriva because the Jews complained against God. So because it's one story, Moshe was punished at Masa Meriva, which is the same place they punished it. Basically, all those repeat stories, they're all the same. And therefore, it's not true. Moshe didn't stick up for them then. He didn't stick up for them. You know, you see Moshe being angry when he hits the rock later on by Midbar? Yeah. It wasn't like the first time he hit the rock, he wasn't angry, and the second time he was. He hit the rock once, and he got angry. You just didn't hear about it in Shemot. Moshe always gets angry at the people, whatever they complain. It's not, this is nothing new. When Nechama Leibovich quotes it and notes that nobody, absolutely nobody reads this. The key to the story seems to be simply the fact that it's the second time. At least one of the keys, the beginning of it is that it's the second time, is that we're, it's one thing for the Jews to complain for food when they just got out of Mitzrayim, but now God has been supporting them for a year. Complaining now is much, you know, more ungrateful. You're saying to God, you've been giving us food, but I don't like the food that you're giving us. You're giving us water, but you know, we're still, we don't believe you can give us more water, even though you've been giving us for 40 years, right? We don't believe you could perform another miracle. It's the second time around. You should have learned your lesson. And also, but this is really what I want to focus on. This is what we haven't talked about yet. It's more than that. And that is, if you look in Shemot, so this is, I gave it to you in number 3, at the end of the story, I think we talked about this when we did B'Shalach a long time ago, said, Vayikra Hashem makom masa umirival, riv b'nei Yisrael v'anasotam et Hashem lemor, hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu em ayin. When Moshe describes why he called the place Masa Meriva, he says that the reason it's called Masa Meriva, what was the test? What were the Jews testing? They were testing the God, testing God and asking him, is God among us or not? Is he present among us or not? And we, at the time, we proved, we went through the Psukim to sort of argue this, that even though the Jews, their complaint about food and then water and food again, the fact that Moshe can summarize the whole story and say that what they really were asking was, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu emayin, was that that wasn't really what was going on at all. What was going on in the story was really, they just left Egypt, and they didn't know, is God going to take care of us? And as soon as they didn't have food, they panicked, and they said, oh, God was so good to us in Mitzrayim, but maybe he doesn't care about us enough to escort us through the desert. So God gives them food. And then they don't have water. Now, it's true, they don't have water. That's what they're complaining about. What they're really scared about is God has abandoned them. And then they complain about food again. Each time, they're talking about food, but they really want is...
reassurance.
What?
Reassurance.
Yeah, they want reassurance that somebody cares, that God cares about them, right? In, you know, the it's what kids do, right? If, you know, if you yell at your kid because they did something wrong, right? They, you know, when they run over and they want whatever, they want dessert. You know, they want extra dessert once, you know, you've calmed down. It's not because they want dessert. They want to feel loved. They need to know that you, right, even though you're angry at them, you care about them. Or they, right, if you're not paying attention to them, right, they ask you anything to get your attention. Doesn't matter what they ask. And the Jews are doing that, which, while they should have known that God was with them, he just took them out of Egypt, he took care of them. On the end of the day, how angry can you get, right? You can tell that your kids just want to know that you care. So, like, you know, you, even if you're, you know, you sort of focus in, you show them, yeah, I care. You know, maybe you shouldn't have asked that, but I can't blame you for wanting to know that I care. So in B'Shalach, Moshe doesn't get too angry, Hashem doesn't get angry. They just, you want food? Okay. I'll give you food. You want water? I'll give you water. Maybe you should have known I didn't abandon you, but the sentiment is fine. But in our parsha, that's not what happens. And this is something that Rav Samet picks up on, and this is where I want to come to. So if you skip to 5, maybe I'll come back to... right, meaning in 4, I just, you know, I gave you a bit of a... a chiastic structure for my waxman on this, but just for the sake of time, I'll leave it. You can look at sort of the structure of the story. But I think Rav Samet really picks up on something, and he notes, he said, if you want to know what's different now and why this begins a leadership crisis, you've got to look at the imagery and the words in this story. And he contrasted. In B'Shalach, the people that we're talking about want to know that God is among them. Fundamentally, they care about God. They want just God to care back. And that's something that we can deal with. But if you look at our parsha, you know, if we just run through the story and we look at the words, right? I'll sort of skim through it. The rabble amongst them desired to desire. And they said, who will feed us meat? I remember the fish, and then the gourds, and the watermelon, and the onions, and the eggplant. And now our souls are dry, all we have is the man. And then Moshe hears them. Moshe says to God, where am I going to get manly basar? Where am I going to get all this meat? That they should say to me, give me all this meat. And you look at how many times the word meat comes up, or meat, fish, right? There's like very visceral images of the food. He notes that the psukim are indicating that this isn't a spirit, this isn't like Bashalach, where what they were really asking is we want assurance that God is with us. This time, it's we want meat, right? It's this just hedonistic impulse. Like, it's not enough to have a relationship with God. We want meat. And Moshe, when he responds to God, he says, where am I going to get meat for all of them? And then Rav Samet notes, sort of strikingly, that this seems to be, to bring it home, the psukim seem to push this on the central imagery of Moshe's complaint. Right? He said, the central imagery is as follows. You have all these people asking meat, right? Asking for meat. And what does Moshe say? I can't handle it, right? Did I conceive them? Did I give birth to them? Like a nursemaid will carry the baby. Then what's the image? Here are these people just asking for meat, and the image he says, "Am I their mother, right, to nurse them?" And there's this stark contrast between the meat and the, you know, this sort of hedonistic explosion and the nursing imagery. And he writes in number 5, he said, well, what's important is the parallel between the two questions is neither their linguistic nor their compositional similarity, but rather the harshly grotesque contrast between them. The image of a young infant at his mother's breast is an idyllic one, full of gentleness. More even than the infant wishes to suckle, the mother wishes to nurse him. The infant himself is helpless, unable to voice his wish to his mother, while the mother's milk is within herself, ready to be given to him. If the relationship between Moshe and the nation was like this, the monologue would arouse no identification with Moshe's complaint. But at the beginning of the second half, the infant displays teeth, opens a demanding mouth, and shouts at its nurse with hysterical crying of its multitudes, give us meat that we may eat. The infant, hungry for its mother's milk in the first half, has undergone an artistic metamorphosis and has become an angry nation demanding of its leader, its nurse, and I would add here, its male nurse. Right? It's not even an image that exists. Right? It's a male, Omein is a male wet nurse, which is not even a physical possibility, not to drink its mother's milk, but rather to eat meat. And so the nurse asks, from where do we have meat? Right? And the imagery seems to be pointing you in the fact that this isn't. This is different because this is just pure hedonism. This isn't any more spirituality. This is, they want meat. And Moshe brings that front and center when he says, am I their mother who should be taking care of them gently? But they're, right, it's the image of a little baby who should be having milk, right? Milk from, you know, God, essentially, right? Man, this sort of pure, white, you know, perfect food, sort of like a mother's milk, right, which God is giving them, which just provides all the nutrients that you possibly need. You don't need anything else, right? A baby who's nursing doesn't need anything else, just his mother's milk. That's the idyllic picture that the Jews actually are experiencing, and yet they're screaming, it's that baby who has everything he needs, which is screaming for a, you know, a double hamburger, right? Which is just weird. It's just, right, disgusting. It's just, you're, you know, you look at it and you would just say, this is, something is wrong, right? This child who looks like he has everything in the world and should have everything, he barely has teeth, right? He shouldn't even have teeth yet, and he has teeth, right? It's like it's a fully grown baby. And Moshe is bringing the image and saying, this image is just so, right? It's discordant. The people have perfect sustenance. You are giving them man, which is like a mother's milk, which gives the children, the nation, everything they need. And they don't want it because they want food. They want meat, right? They're just desiring. And that, Rassamit notes, is what starts to really, right, drives Moshe crazy. He hasn't dealt with this yet. He's dealt with people complained, but this is the first time where they just don't care. They don't want what God has given them. They don't want that idyllic existence. They're just giving in to their base passions, and he can't handle it. So then what happens? So what's the solution? And this is where we pick up in the story. In the middle of the story, before we get food, the psukim say, "Vayomer Adonai Moshe, Asvali Shivim Ish, Mizikne Yisrael Asher Yadata Ki Heim Zikneh Am V'Shodra V'Lakachta Otam Elom Oed V'Tiatzvu Shamimach." So God says, "Gather for me 70 sages that you know they're the leaders, and you'll take them to Elom Oed, and they'll stand with you." V'Yarati V'Dibartim Chasham V'Atzaltim In Aruach Asher Alecha. I'll come down, I'll speak to you, and I'll give of my spirit to you, and I'll put my spirit on them as well. And you won't carry them alone. They'll carry the people with you. So why do the Psukim continue with this? I mean, God is going to answer their request for food. So why do we have the story of the Zekanim in the middle of this story? Right, we only pick up later where he gives them, right? It continues, right? V'alam tomar hitkashu l'machar. He said, and then tell the people that tomorrow, get ready, v'achaltem basar yoli meat, ki b'chitem bazne Hashem le'mor mi'achleinu basar, because you've cried saying, who will give us meat? Ki tov lanu b'mitzrayim v'natan, Hashem lochem basar v'achaltem, God will give you meat, and you'll eat it. Lo yom echad tochum, lo yomayim, lo chamisha yamim, lo asarayamim, lo asrim yom, chodesh yamim asher yitzei me'apchem, vayalachem lezara yam, ki ma'astem at Hashem, asher b'kir b'chem, v'tivku lefanav le'mor, lama zei yitzanam v'mitzrayim. Because what you really wanted, what you really were saying, was why did we leave Egypt? And that's what we talked about sort of last time. I'm going to give you what you want. I'm going to give you, right, meat for 30 days. You're going to get as much meat as you want. You know, and this is, you know, one of the times where you see that sometimes, you know, sometimes God gives you what you need, and sometimes God gives you what you want. Right here, this is not what they need. It's going to kill them. Right? They're going to die with the meat in their mouth. He gives them what they want, not what they need. He said, you despise me? Fine. I'm not going to take your best interests at heart. I will show you that I can do it, but it's going to be bad. And that's what happens. Right? He brings the meat, and right, and it skips all the way. You know, you skip down to when it actually happens. Vayesef Moshe al machaneh v'uzuk neYisrael v'ruach nasam me'ed Hashem v'agash salvim emin ayam v'itosh al machaneh k'rach yom kov v'derach yom kov v'yor al machaneh k'matayim al p'nei aretz. The meat just piles up, right? It's that same grotesque imagery. It's just God blows in this meat, and it's 2 cubits everywhere, right? It's you know, 3 to 4 feet worth of meat just everywhere in the entire camp. It's just disgusting and, right, overwhelming. And they go and these collect, and while it's still in their mouth, God strikes them down and they die.
Doesn't say how many
here. But some of them die, right? It's clearly, it's bad. It's bad. But what stands out in this parsha is that smack in the middle of this, in the middle of the food story, right? It's, you follow the logic of it. It's, they ask for meat. Moshe says, I can't handle this. God says, don't worry, I'm going to get them food, right? At the end of the story, he gets them food. But in the middle, he says, but go get yourself 70 sages and give them of your spirit. And then if you skip to Chav Gimel in the middle, he says, "Vayomer Adonai Moshe, Yadonai Tiksar, Atatirai Yikarcha Devarim Lo." You'll see if God's hand is capable of this or not. Vayisei Moshe v'Daber El Ha'am et Devrei Adonai v'Yasof Shivim Ish Mizikne Ha'am v'Yamed Of Tam Sivot Oel. And Moshe brings the 70 sages. Vayir Adonai Be'anan v'Daber Elav V'Yetzam Ben Aruach Asher Elav V'Yitene Al Shivim Ish Azkenim V'Hi Kenoch Lehem Aruach V'Nabu V'Lo Yasafu. And then the Spirit of God descended onto these 70 sages, and they prophesized, and they didn't either stop or they didn't continue. It could be either, it could be opposite. And there were two people who stayed in the camp, Eldad and Medad, and the Spirit of God rested on them. And they didn't leave the Oel, and they prophesied in the camp. And then the Nar was Yoshua. Runs. And he said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. And Yoshua told Moshe, stop them, right? Imprison them. Are you being righteous for my sake, zealous for me? If only God would give his spirit to all the Jewish people, they would all be prophets. So you look at this story, and it's very confusing. It doesn't make any sense. Right? It starts off with meat. Then God says, I will get the meat. But he pauses in the middle, gives them the whole destruction, and the 70 skate him. But it actually just goes back and forth. Right? It's they complain for meat. Moshe complains to God. God says, get 70 skate him. Then God says, I'll give them meat. Then God gives his prophecy to the 70 skate him. And then he gives meat. Right? Like, the story just keeps sort of flipping back and forth. And the Torah seems like it's telling two simultaneous stories at the same time. But it's not really true. It's telling one story. And the story it's telling isn't the story we think it's telling. Because we tend to think of the story, the basis of the story, the focus of the story is the meat. But the focus of the story isn't the meat. The focus of the story is Moshe's response to the meat. It's right. It's the crisis of leadership. And Rosamit notes that you can tell that this is one big story. It's meant to be linked because the word that connects the whole story is Vayasof. Right? It's Vayasof. Right? It's the gatherings. Is the people gather. So God responds by gathering 70 Skenim. Because the story really goes like this. The people say, the Asaf Suf, right? The gathered people, the gathered masses say to Moshe, we want meat. Moshe, because this is the second time around, because they want to go back to Mitzrayim, because they don't understand the relationship with God, whatever reasons, he loses his patience. And he says to God, I can't handle this. I can't carry them. Right? That's the key image here. I can't carry them. So God said, okay, the real problem here is not with them. I mean, it is them. They made a big mistake. But the first problem I got to deal with is that normally I have Moshe to intercede. And Moshe has had it. Moshe has lost patience. So I've really got to solve is Moshe. I've got to help Moshe. So he says, okay, Asfali Shivim Ish Mizikne Yisrael. Gather, right, in response to the people, their Asaf Suf, they are gathering, so you gather 70 skenim. Why? And he says explicitly, "Vinasu itcha b'masaham." They will carry the weight of the people with you. Meaning, it's a response. I can't carry them alone. So Hashem says, "Okay, you don't have to carry them alone. I'll give you other people to carry the Jewish people with you." But how does he do it? I gave you, you know, an extensive piece of Rabbi Simon. I'm not going to read through all of it, but just if you want to sort of see his detailed explanation. But he says to Moshe, look, if what the problem is, you can't carry the people, so I'll give you people to carry them with carry the people with you. It's the same imagery, right? You can't carry them. I'll give you people who will help you carry. But God isn't just going to give him people to carry them. He's right, Moshe, God's smarter than that. God says, if I'm going to help you, I've got to get the right type of people to help you. It's not just a manpower thing. Right? 70 against several million is still not going to help you unless there's a chachma behind how you are organizing the response. And it's clear that they're a response because they are the response to the Asaf Suf. The response to the Asaf Suf is Asfali Shivim Ish. But the response is very careful. Because what was the problem? The people are obsessively hedonistic, and Moshe doesn't know how to deal with it. So Hashem says to him, here's my solution. Get 70s kanim, and what am I going to do? V'yaradti v'dibarti imcha sham v'atzalti min haruach asher alecha v'samti aleihem. I'll take of your spirit, and I'll put it on them. So Rav Salman said it's very simple. What is the solution to an overemphasis on basar? Ruach. Moshe is right now the only Ish Ruach. He's the spiritual leader of a group of hedonists. The response is to get more spiritual people who will teach people how to not be obsessed with basar. So he said, okay, you can handle dealing with these hedonists, fine. They have their Asaf Suf, their gathered people who want basar. Gather for me your own Asefa, and I'll give them Ruach. And you'll have a Ruach response to basar. You'll have a spirit response to flesh. It's a very sort of simple dichotomy that we talk about, right? Body versus spirit, or flesh versus spirit, flesh versus soul. So God says, yeah, the response to flesh, the response to basar is Ruach. And that's what you need. Get 70 people, and I'll give you the spirit. And, Rav Samet goes through different places in Tanakh where basar and ruach are seen as opposites. And, if you just skip to the end of F here, this is the second page, right? The second to left paragraph in F, he says, Hashem is hinting to Moshe here that first the nation must be dealt with in a constructive way. The formal point of departure is indeed Moshe's personal complaint. But in Hashem's response, this becomes a platform for the elevation of the nation's spirit through the consolidation of a broad leadership of 70 elders who will acquire some of Moshe's spirit. Moshe feels that he cannot deal with a nation that is so distant from him and bridge the abyss that exists between them. Hashem's response is that he indeed needs a bridge between himself and the nation. These 70 elders are on the one hand authentic representatives of the nation among the elders of the nation's officers, but on the other hand, some of Moshe's spirit will rest upon them, so they will be able to draw the nation after Moshe's spirit instead of them being drawn after the multitude in their midst. Right, so Simon pushes it a bit farther. It's not just men of spirit, but it's men of spirit who aren't Moshe. It's people. It's take people out of the Jewish people, put your spirit on them, and then send them back. You need a bridge. You can't handle it by yourself. So I'm not asking you to have 70 more people at the top. I'm asking you to take people who can be leaders from within and will be a bridge between you and them. And then he says something which I think is very clever. And he said, okay. Everyone asked, all the Mefarshim ask, what is going on with Eldad and Medad? Right? If you have 70 Zkenim who are in with Moshe prophesying, why do you have two people who are prophesizing in the camp? What is the point of this whole story? So he, Sir Samit puts it as this. He said, okay, you really got to ask. There's a fundamental question here. What is the point of the 70 Zkenim? One is to just say that Moshe can't handle the bureaucracy anymore and he needs technical assistance. Or it can be, as we said before, that it's not technical assistance. What he needs is that people are going to help him change the spirit of the nation. But if that's the case, it's important not just to have people with Moshe, it's important to have people in the camp. And the existence of Eldad and Medad prove that you don't just have to be with Moshe to be a prophet to internalize the spirit of God. You can be in the camp too. And then he says, well, what happens? Eldad and Medad prophesies in the camp. And what happens? The Na'ar comes to Moshe and he says, what do you do? You can't let them prophesy in the camp. And Moshe responds to them, really? Why not? And he says to him, I'm a Kanaatali. You're zealous for me. Umi yiten kol am Hashem neviim. And this is the key. Ki yiten Hashem rucho aleihem. That same word, the ruach. He said, no, this is not about me. I'm glad that there are prophets in the camp. I'd rather God's spirit descend on everybody. This is the problem, is that they're all obsessed with basar. So God is giving me anshei ruach. Most of them are with me. But if some people are going to be prophesizing in the camp, that's not a failure. That's the ultimate success. That means that the power of Ruach, the response to this hedonism, has penetrated into the camp. You think that it's a challenge to my leadership? This isn't about my leadership. I can't handle the leadership because I can't manage to reorient the philosophy of the people. But if God could manage to get all the people to prophesy so that they would be Anshei Ruach also, go ahead. That's what I need. That's what I want. That's the whole point of this solution of the Asfali Shivim Ish. It's not just because I can't handle the leadership. It's because I can no longer get the message across. But if people in the camp are prophesizing, we've gotten somewhere. And then Rav Samet notes that this is Eldad and Medad may be the sort of epitome of this spirit coming out into the people, but to prove that that was the goal of all the Zkenim, we have to just go back to the story where, again, as we've seen, these stories are interwoven, the story of the Shivim Zkenim and the story of giving meat. But here, right, when Hashem tells him about the meat, he tells him that they are going to go with him. Right, he says, "I'm going to give the spirit to them." Velaam tomar, and then he tells them that go communicate with the people that they're going to get meat to get together. And then when he actually does it, he says, "Vayitzei Moshe vayidaber al ha'am et divrei Adonai vayasof shivim ish mizekenei ha'am vayamed otam sivot ha'ohel." As he's telling the people about the meat, he's bringing this Zkenim as part of this communication. Like, their goal isn't just to be Moshe's helpers. They're there as God is, as he's talking to them at the meat. Hashem is simultaneously telling the people, "I'm going to give you meat," and putting his spirit on 70 people who will now be their leaders. The image is that God tells Moshe, "I want you to communicate that I'm going to give them meat," while they see 70 new people getting my spirit. It's supposed to be people who are going to counteract that obsession with meat going out into the people. So do it at the same time. And then he says, well, what is the, right? And then he said, what is the lesson of this story? The lesson of the story is that instead of despair and helplessness, you should respond to flesh with spirit, and you should respond to a group of, you know, an Asaf Suf with an Asefa. Meaning, if the problem is that people need a reorientation, so reorient them. Don't just give up. Find people to help you. Find people who can counteract the spirit of the people. So this story, right, the interwoven stories, on the one hand, yes, it shows sort of what's different about the Jewish people and why Moshe is getting so frustrated, but it's also the time when Moshe really concludes that he doesn't have what it takes anymore to single-handedly change and educate the people. He needs not just technical help. He's not capable anymore of changing the tide of the people's spirit, or lack thereof. He needs help, right? And this is when you start to see him weakening. Now, Hashem gives him help, but as we see in the rest of the story, it is really the beginning of Moshe's weakening as a leader, right? It doesn't fully help. It helps somewhat, but the next stories are all about how Moshe is no longer capable of doing things by himself. And, you know, right, David Foreman likes noting that if you look at the beginning of Dvarim, it's almost as if Moshe blames himself for everything that happens afterwards. Because in the middle, right at the beginning of Dvarim, Moshe is retelling his story, and he's saying how things happen in the desert. So he says, and this is Perek Aleph Pasuk Tet, this is really the first round of Zkenim, not the second one, but the first one already in Parshas Yisro. He says, "I had said then already that I can't carry them alone." Now, he actually didn't, right? That language of "I can't carry them" is borrowed from this Parsha, right? He never said it. Yitro said it to him, that you can't do this by yourself. But that language of "I can't carry the people" is really from here. And Moshe is telling you at some level that was true in Yisrael already. In Yisrael, I already started realizing I couldn't do this by myself. I couldn't carry them. And I'd said, how can I carry by myself all of your complaints? So I had appointed Shoftim, I got other leaders. And then the next story he tells you already is he skips straight from that story to the story of the Meraglim. Right? Nothing in between. As if like that was the whole desert experience. Moshe and Yisro giving up some of his leadership the first time around, and then the Meraglim. And Rav Forman suggests that, you know, especially in light of this language, what Moshe is doing at some level, saying, at some level it's my fault, is, at some point I said I can't handle it. Now, even though I got Skanim, once I started, you know, once I couldn't handle it myself, and I needed other people, that was what led to the Meraglim. That was just another failed leadership where I just couldn't manage to get it. Now, he takes this in a different direction, right? That he's blaming himself because, you know, because of him, the people lost hope. But I would take it differently. It's very simple. Moshe wasn't capable anymore of educating the people by himself. He needed help. But there's a danger with needing help. And that is, what if the leaders themselves don't turn out to be that great? Which is what happens by the Meraglim. You've got 10 people who are supposed to be that middle ground who's helping Moshe educate the people, and they're representatives of the people, and they turn out to push the people's spirit in the other direction. Once Moshe reveals that he can't educate the people by himself, he needs help, if your helpers fail, you can't do it alone. You can't turn the tide. And that really is what starts, and you, this is where you see, as much as Hashem is helping him and saying, okay, why don't you try to counteract it? This is the beginning where you see Moshe's leadership deteriorating, or just not because, it's not his fault, right? It's very hard for one person to be able to counteract all complaints and all problems and all sins and all desires of an entire people. But it is the first time you really see that breakdown. You see Moshe saying, I just can't do it myself. I need to rely on other people. And when you need to rely on other people, it might not turn out so well. And that's what happens. But maybe the next story is, yeah, it doesn't turn out so well. Because you said you need help. Okay, Korach comes and said, I want to be that person. Right? We're all holy. Why are those people the people who are going to be holy? I got an idea. I want to be the holy one. And then you have the Meraglim, who are these leaders, and they say, well, we're the leaders, and we think we should go back to Egypt. Right? Once things are not with you, it may be totally understandable, but it's also the beginning of you depending on other people. And once that happens, if they're good, it'll be good. If they're bad, it'll be really bad. And that's really the story of Bamidbar. Now, Chazal, on the Eldad and Medad story, I gave you in 6 and 7 the sort of a more detailed story of how this happens. I'll say it outside, but basically, the way Chazal explained the story is as follows. How do we get to 70 Skanim and then 2 in the camp? So their argument is as follows. You have 72 people. Well, where 72 come from? So he said 72 is 6 times 12. So probably that means there were 6 Skanim from every Shevet, which sort of makes sense. If you want to have a balanced leadership, you get equal number from each Shevet. The problem is that Hashem had said 70, and 70 isn't 72, which means that 2 Shvatim are going to lose out. They're only going to get 5. So how are you going to tell each Shevet you only get 5 leaders? No one wants to be the one that only gets 5. Everyone wants to be the one with 6. So Moshe said, you know what, I'm going to have a lottery. Now, the Gemara goes to different ways of the lottery, but in the end, what the Gemara says is he put 72 pieces of paper in the pot, which each said, Zakein, right, and then 2 blank ones. This way, there's 72. So no one can say, hey, I just picked the last one, so I got the blank one. There's 74 pieces of paper total. Everyone theoretically could pick up one that says Zakein, but they're not going to. It's going to be a miracle, and God's going to make sure that 2 people who shouldn't be this Canaan will be left out, and then no one can complain. Eldad and Medad are very humble, and therefore they say, we're not going to even come, because if we come, two people are going to be left out. If we just stay home, so everybody who goes will end up being one of those Zakenim. So they just stay in the camp. But it turns out that they are not the two that are being excluded. On the the opposite. They are the greatest of the bunch. So God rewards them for their humility. And not only do they prophesize, but they can prophesize in the camp. And they can prophesize without Moshe, or the other ones can only prophesize with Moshe there. They're prophesizing the camp, and this is God's, and this is their reward. Okay. That's a sort of fascinating analysis in and of itself of Eldad and Medad's personalities, but I want to try to focus on the bigger themes in the book. So the last thing that the Gemara says, though, and this ties in to everything we've been talking about, is the Gemara then asks, okay, well, what did they prophesy? Or what did they say? So the simplest shot, David Berger notes this in his shir, is that no one said anything, right? There's two different types of prophecy in Tanakh. There's prophecy with a message, and then there's sort of ecstatic connection to God without any content. Just, reaching a certain spiritual level where you're just sort of, you feel God's presence. And the fact that we don't hear what they said means that the simplest shot is just that's what they're getting, some sort of ecstatic prophecy. But the Gemara assumes that at least Eldad and Medad are getting an actual message. So this is the bottom of the third page, number 7. So this is the Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Yud Zayin. So like halfway through. Right? It's what nevuah did they get? So Abba Chanan Omer, no, it's but then the Gemara says, okay, did they continue prophesizing, not prophesizing, right? Was this the only time they prophesized or not? But then he said, okay, this is the second line of the Gemara in number 7, the end, the last two words on the page, on the line. Umanivuan it nabu. What was the prophecy that they said? Amru, Moshe mate, Yoshua machnis et Yisrael la'aretz. They said Moshe is going to die and Yeshua is going to take over. And you think, where did Chazal get the notion that their prophecy is Moshe is going to die and Yeshua is going to be the one to lead them into the land? But I think the answer is simple. Because that was the fact that they need to be prophesizing in the camp is indicative of the fact that Moshe isn't the person who's going to be able to take the merit to Israel. This is the proof. The proof that Moshe couldn't handle the people anymore is the proof, is the reason that Yoshua needs to take over. So they said, what was their prophecy? Chazal are being very sharp here. I don't know if that's what they said, but that was the import of what they said. The fact that there needed to be other prophets to lead the people was screaming to the people that Moshe mate, Yoshua machnis Israel laretz, that there will be other leaders because Moshe isn't the right leader anymore. He's not going to be the one who's able to take them in. Abba Chanan Omer Mishumri Lazar Eske Slav Hein Mitnabin. And Abba Chanan says no. They were prophesizing about the quail, about the Slav, which is also part of the story. I mean, there's different parts of the story. They're doing two things. One is their prophecy is a response to the Slav. The other thing is that it's a response to Moshe's failing leadership. So Abba Chanan and the Tanakhama here, they're two attempts at what their nevuah are really highlighting the two themes of the story. They're either prophesizing about the Slav, or they're prophesizing about Moshe, or in other ways, maybe they're even arguing about this. What is the real story going on here? Is the main import of this whole story the impact on Moshe's leadership, or is the impact on the people? It's not clear. Both are really true. And they're either arguing or presenting two aspects of what's going on. But Eldad and Medad's prophecy in the camp is indicative of two things. One is that you need a spiritual response to the Slav, and the other is that Moshe, who needs more people to help him, is not going to be the one to take them into Israel. And then Rav Nachman Amar Iskei Gog Umagog Hayum Nabin, he says, no, they're actually prophesizing about the end of days, but the war of Gog Umagog, and that already I don't know exactly what the Gemara wants from that. Okay. Okay. The Gemara then has an even, what I think is an even more beautiful midrashic take on this story. In the middle of the Gemara has a whole discussion of did they continue prophesizing or not, right? Lo yasaf can either mean they never stopped prophesizing or that they never prophesized again. It can mean, right, two opposite things. Again, I gave it to you, you can look at it. But at the end, the Yeshua says, Klaim, right, imprison them. So the Gemara says, well, why? Right? Why did Yehoshua tell them to imprison them? So the Gemara has several positions. And you can look at the English, right? It's at the end of 7 here. Okay. What is the reason that Joshua said, my master Moses imprisoned them? So the Gemara answers, he said this because it is not proper conduct for them to prophesy publicly in close proximity to Moses, as by doing so, they are like a student who teaches halacha in his teacher's presence, which is inappropriate. So Yehoshua says, according to this position of the Gemara, that what they're doing is disrespectful. Right? You are the prophet, you're the leader, they can't prophesy without you there. Now that's a very telling read of the story, right? Is that this is wrong. At some level, this is a challenge to your authority. Because even though the 70 Zizkanim are a challenge to your authority, they're at least only getting your spirit next to you. But if you need to not just have people next to you, you need people in the camp independent of you, that's a real challenge to your authority. And Yehoshua said, that's wrong. And Moshe said, okay, but I wish it would happen anyways. But that's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. As Yehoshua said, this is the beginning of, right, they're challenging your authority. And Moshe said, that may be true, but the alternative is worse. I'd rather people prophesize. That's okay. But Yehoshua may still be right. Yeshua may still be right that this is a challenge to Moses' authority, even if that's not what they mean to do. It substantively is a challenge to his authority. And then the Gemara continues. If we skip down a few lines, the Gemara says Klaim might mean something else. Maybe Klaim doesn't mean imprison them. Maybe it means give them leadership and Haim Kalim Me Alehem. Right, Kalim could mean imprison, but could also mean to like self-destruct, right? So to be just destroyed. So the Gemara says maybe Yehoshua didn't tell Moshe to imprison them. He said, they want leadership? Give it to them. And trust me, they'll collapse, right? And they'll stop prophesizing or prophesying. But that's also a really telling midrash, because what the midrash is saying, right? You think about what the midrash is doing. It's saying, Moshe is saying, I can't handle this anymore. So Yehoshua says, look, there are other people prophesizing. I have a solution. Give them your job, and they'll stop prophesizing. Now, the Gemara, in sort of a backhanded way, is saying, yeah, that's exactly what's happening to Moshe. He's not losing his prophecy, but it's wearing on him. The communal leadership is wearing on him. So Yehoshua sort of ironically says, well, give... they want leadership? Give it to them and see how much longer they can handle having the Spirit of God on them. It's very hard to maintain that pristine level of spirituality if you're actually involved in the nitty-gritty, the day-to-day with the Jewish people. And I think that these, you know, this Gemara, like all the different sort of elements, is a very nice midrashic way of sort of pulling out the elements of the story. What are they prophesizing about? We'll focus on two of them. Either the Slav, because that's their role, is to respond spiritually to the obsession with meat, or they're prophesizing about the end of Moshe's leadership, because the fact that you need Eldad and Medad is indicative of the fact that he is sort of weakening. And then when Yehoshua comes to that, to Moshe and says, stop them, because this is a challenge to your authority, it is a challenge to your authority. And then the Gemara says, and what's the way to stop them from challenging your authority? Give them your job and see if they can handle it. But what he's really saying is, yeah, because the only reason that they can be so free and spiritual and be, you know, carefree is because they don't yet have your job. But if we gave them your job, they wouldn't handle it just like you can't. Right? That's really what he may not say those words, but the Gemara is putting those words in his mouth. And when you take it together, right, what you see is that the Midrash is sort of beautifully pulling together the themes of this story, which is that the crisis here is that Moshe can no longer handle this unbridled hedonism. He doesn't have the spirit in him Why doesn't he have the Spirit in him? Because it's hard to say that spiritual when you're leading and you're involved in bureaucracy and the day-to-day. It's really hard, and it's hard to do it by yourself, so he needs other people. But once you need other people, that is a challenge to your authority. You can't have it both ways. And what's the solution? Right? You don't want them to challenge your authority? Give them your authority. If you give them their authority, they'll stop being a challenge to your leadership because they won't be able to be spiritual anymore. Right? It's a catch-22. Right? If they're not leaders, they can be spiritual. If they're leaders, they can't be spiritual. But he's basically highlighting beautifully the catch that Moshe's in is if you're a leader, at some point it wears you down and you can't by yourself carry the spirit of the people. But allowing people to just have spirit without having leadership roles is pointless. So give them leadership. But that's the tension. That's the problem. Moshe is trying as hard as he can. He's getting as many people as he can, but he's weakening. He can't, or he just can't handle the stress anymore because it's too much to do it by himself. And that's understandable, right? He's not saying it's a bad thing. Give them communal leadership and they'll stop prophesizing. It's just sometimes what happens. And that's the tragedy of the story. And then, you know, Rav Tversky notes in his book, in Amita Shel Torah, that if you want confirmation that Yoshua is right, that this is the beginning, that by allowing Eldad and Medad around, it's going to challenge his leadership, all you need to do is look at the next pasuk. Because the next pasuk is Miriam and Aaron start complaining about Isha Kushita Sherlakach, Vayomru Harak Ach B'Moshe Diber Hashem. What did Moshe and Aaron say? Did God only speak to Moshe? He spoke to us too. So Tversky said, well, where do you think they got that from? Why did Moshe and Aaron, Miriam and Aaron never complain about Moshe before? Because Moshe was up on a pedestal. He was the only person who talked to God up in heaven. He was carrying the whole nation by himself. But once Moshe says, I can't do it by myself, and God says, okay, bring in other people who are going to prophesy, that means I'm not unique. I mean, he is unique. That's what God responds, right? God responds to them, no, you got it wrong. Moshe is unique. He is the best Navi. He is the greatest. And even the greatest person who ever lived can't handle this people by himself. That's not because he's not great enough. But why did Miriam and Aaron suddenly say, isn't he just like us? Because by bringing in other people, because you can't handle it by yourself, what the message that you're sending to everybody is, I'm not that unique, right? I can't do it by myself. I need other people. But those other people, by definition, are like me. Because if they weren't like me, how would it help? He's beginning the process. And you see it even in his own family. It starts breaking down their confidence that he's unique. And God has to go out of his way to punish Miriam miraculously to try to drive home the point to the people that even though Moshe needs help, he's still unique. But that's not easy. Once you start needing help, your uniqueness is called into question. Once your uniqueness is called into question, people start challenging your leadership. Once they start challenging your leadership, things will just start spiraling out of control. So you can't have it both ways. You can try doing it by yourself, and then you can't handle it. You can try bringing other people in, but then you undermine your leadership by strengthening it. There's no other way around it. You've just... And that's the conundrum that Moshe's in, is that he tried to do it all by himself, to highlight that I spoke to God, I can carry you, I can do this. He can't. But once he can't, he may not be wrong. It may not be that we can judge him. It may not be his fault that he can't handle it anymore. But once you bring other people in, that begins all the dangers that you see, where your own family start to challenge your role as leader, where you have Korach saying, isn't everybody holy? Well, why? Where did he get this notion? Why now? Well, of course now he's saying, isn't everybody holy? Because more people are becoming holy. More people are being brought into the circle. The more people you bring in, the more people want to come into the circle. Where did the Meraglim get their influence? Because Moshe needs people, intermediaries, to influence the people. But if those intermediaries go bad, everyone goes with them. And these stories, even without blaming Moshe, it just describes what is happening, is that Moshe, by being overwhelmed and bringing other people into the circle, is beginning the process where leadership is pulled away from him, and that rebellion happens, and other people take over his role. And just to end with one last point. Maybe I should even do this next week, but I'll mention it now. Moshe, Miriam and Aaron start saying, is Moshe so great? Right? Is he different than the rest of us? God's answer is, yes, he is different than the rest of us. The Midrash is a very beautiful way of pointing out how he's different than the rest of them, and that's their point about Yehoshua. The Midrash points out that eventually, when Moshe dies and Yehoshua is chosen, the Midrash builds up the idea that the people freak out. They don't know what to do with themselves. They've had Moshe, now they have Yehoshua. And they said, you want to know why the people would be scared of Yehoshua? Because you meet him twice, in Chumash before he's leader. He has two speaking roles in the whole Torah. One is here, and one is when Moshe comes down from Har Sinai. Both times, the Midrash says in Kohelet Rabbah, he totally messes up. Here, Moshe has decided that everyone needs to be prophets and that God's spirit should be amongst the people. And Moshe, what does Yehoshua say? Claim, right? Stop it. In Yisro, Kitisa, with the Egel Azav, Moshe says, what is that noise? What is that rabble? And Yehoshua says, oh, it's war. And Moshe says, it's not war. Right? That's rebellion. Don't you know rebellion when you hear it? So the Midrash says, Moshe, for all his flaws, he understood the people. He may not always have been able to handle it, but he understood the people. Yehoshua, before he's appointed leader, the only two times he talks, he messes up royally. He doesn't even perceive the people. He doesn't know what's going on with the people. Right? He doesn't recognize rebellion. He thinks that to be a leader means to leave all the spirit of God with the leader and not allow anyone to have prophecy without him. And Moshe has to chastise him both times. So the Midrash says, you know why the people freak out? Because it's not just that it's not Moshe. It's that it is Yehoshua. That for all his greatness and for all of Moshe's flaws, Moshe understood the people. He may not have been able to handle it, but he was the best prophet, and he did understand the people. It was too much at some point. Yehoshua has a learning curve, because Yehoshua hasn't yet even gotten to the point where he understands them. Moshe at least understands it, even if he can't handle it. Yehoshua can't even understand it. So the Midrash of Golas Rabbah said, yeah, that's why this gets really bad. Because it's not just that they're going to lose Moshe, but they're going to get Yehoshua. Now, the ultimate irony of it, and this is something that Ray Angel points out, is that despite all that fear, Yehoshua is a much more successful leader than Moshe because he never gets complaints, right? And that's one of the big questions is why Yehoshua, right? Sefer Yehoshua is this idyllic sefer when the Torah is not, right? That's one of the big questions that, you know, we'd have to answer if we were learning Yehoshua. Next week we'll do the story of Miriam and Aaron's complaint over the Shakushit. But what you see from these sort of two interwoven stories is the complexity of Bamidbar as it develops, as Moshe's struggling to deal with the people and struggle with leadership, and how he's caught in this conundrum, this catch 22, where he can't do it by himself. He needs other people, but those people aren't him. Right? You aren't replacing Moshe for 70 Moshes. You're replacing Moshe for a bunch of other people who are going to have influence, and it's not going to be clear how their influence is supposed to relate to Moshe's, and that's going to create problems. It was necessary, as Hashem says, I get it, you can't carry it, if you can't carry it, we don't have a choice. We need more people. That doesn't mean it's not the beginning of the end. Just because something is necessary doesn't mean it doesn't have consequences. And that's what Bamidbar tells you, is there were consequences to this. His family starts challenging him. His shevet starts challenging him. The people challenge him. The leaders challenge him. And everything goes haywire. And Moshe doesn't take them into Eretz Yisrael. But it starts here. Right? It starts here. And that is... So that we'll pick up with that next week.